You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's in-depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project. It's a pleasure to have you with us today on Wednesday, November 18th. It's also a great pleasure and an honor to have with us today Professor Mark Stoller, who is a professor who joined the UVM faculty in 1970 and became a professor emeritus in 2007. Mr. Stoller is an expert in U.S. foreign relations and military history, as well as the origins of the Cold War. And he's also held numerous teaching positions, not only at the University of Vermont, but at the United States Military Academy, the Army Military History Institute, the Naval War College, and as a Fulbright professor at the University of Haifa in Israel. He is also an editor of the papers of George Catlett Marshall, the great American soldier after whom the Marshall Plan was named, and is also the author of several books on military and diplomatic history over his 50-year teaching career. Professor Stoller, a great honor to have you with us today, and thank you very much for making the time to be with us at this shall we say, interesting moment in U.S. history, in yes. The week of an election, still not totally formal yet, I suppose is one way of putting it, but there are so many things going on in the world right now, not just the COVID-19 pandemic, but other things. I mean, all of that never stops, really, but it seems like to me that you know, the election campaign kind of focused a lot around COVID, the economy, domestic issues, foreign policy questions sort of seem to, you know, I won't say take a back seat, but, you know, we're kind of in second place or second tier. But anyway, I just thought it'd be a great time to have you tell us and talk to us a little bit about what do you see as the major foreign policy issues that are going to be facing the incoming Biden administration when it takes office in January? Are there a couple of things that stand out, or is it just sort of a case of continuing on with, relations with Russia and China and other major powers and what have you?
Thank you, Andy. You didn't mention that you were also one of my students at UVM.
I was going to get to that in a little bit. That was back when we both were a lot younger and had a lot more hair.
Exactly. I keep thinking of that great Bob Dylan line, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Right. And may I just say, before you get started, since you raised the point, that your course in American diplomatic history was one of my favorites I took at UVM. It was just a fantastic course and really opened my eyes to a lot of it. I thought I was kind of pretty well versed in historical stuff before I took your course, but I realized I'd only been scraping the top of the barrel there. You took us all on a journey way, way, way beyond all of that. Thank you.
There's that old cliche that the first-year student in college thinks he or she knows everything. The second-year student, almost everything. The junior begins to wonder, and seniors realize how little they actually know. And that process continues, but it was a great joy to have you in class. I remember that time period very, very fondly. But to get to your question, to me, now let me begin, though, by saying I'm a historian. I'm not a political scientist. And historians are very careful not to try to predict the future. We make fools of ourselves, usually, when we do. The problem is that we are part of the continuum that we study. And we project forward from what has happened in the past, which doesn't always work very well. In fact, many times it doesn't. My colleague and dear friend, many years, Professor Sam Hand, used to love to say, historians don't predict the future, historians predict the past. But with that caveat in mind, I think the biggest foreign policy issue facing the incoming Biden administration is obvious. How to restore American credibility in the world, how to restore trust in the United States. I was just listening to the news in regard to Afghanistan and in the negotiations the Trump administration has been having with the Taliban as a classic example. I don't know how it can go about doing that. I mean, there are obvious things it can do, but the rest of the world watched what has happened in the last 4 years. The rest of the world watched how close this election was, watches the fact that the incumbent refuses to accept the result of it. The obvious, how can I trust what the administration is going to say? And how can I trust that this administration is going to be there for a while and that things are not going to change dramatically when the next administration takes power? We're dealing here with psychology as much as anything else. But as I said, if I'm foreign minister of any country or prime minister, I'm going, wait a minute. And I think what we're seeing with NATO, I mean, NATO is saying we have to rely upon ourselves, which is absolutely correct. I think probably one of the worst things the administration did in terms of foreign policy is to destroy that trust by its behavior. So that's where I see it. Now, in terms of, you also have on top of that, the failure to handle the pandemic. Again, every country in the world has than most in terms of number of cases, inability to control it. But there are many other things, just the constant flips that have taken place, the unpredictability of American foreign policy at this point. Biden, with his experience, is going to try to go back to the way things were. But I don't know if he can.
So you're thinking that, some foreign minister or prime minister in European or elsewhere in the world might be saying, well, okay, so they've reset things back to what we used to consider normal, but in 4 years, somebody else could come along and go 180 degrees in the opposite direction again.
Yes.
On a whole different tangent.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Now, in one sense, this is not a new problem, but I think it's been magnified tremendously. But after all these years of American leadership, there was a great deal of trust in the United States that I think has been shattered.
And was it shattered only in the last 4 years, or had this been a process of slowly, gathering steam, going back, let's say, as far back to, the Iraq War, for instance, or maybe even earlier than that? Or was this simply a case where the Trump administration's approach would seem to be, like America first, and we're going to do what we're going to do, and not consulting with allies, not coordinating with them, just was so extreme from past behavior that by itself was a breaking point?
That's an excellent question. Excellent. Of course, there's a lead up to this. Trump didn't spring out of nowhere. And you have had, I would take it all the way back to the Vietnam War, where American credibility and common sense was questioned. There were major efforts to reestablish the credibility of the United States after the Vietnam War that were largely successful, I would say. But then you get 9/11, and the gross overreaction is the wrong word. How do you overreact to what happened on 9/11? But poor reaction. It was also caused by, you know, it wasn't just emotionalism. It was also hubris.
Well, let's look at a couple of the areas in particular that, you know, would seem on the surface to present some challenges to the new incoming administration. I mean, historically, of course, we and the Russians have gone back and forth over one thing or another. China, we have a situation there where it seems like they see themselves as a rising power, relative to us, and not interested in sort of being, you know, sort of this, you know, country that just sort of bobs along in America's wake. And there's a lot of concerns about, you know, security issues on their side of the Pacific Ocean and all of that. It wasn't so long ago that we were all worked up about North Korea. That seems to have gotten a little quieter lately. I'm not sure I know why, but 3 or 4 years ago, it seemed like we were on the verge of a nuclear war with them.
Trump is far from the first president to misunderstand Russia. I keep thinking of Jimmy Carter's comments when Russia invaded Afghanistan. That he had learned more about the Russians in the past few weeks than ever before. And I was saying, where have you been all your life? This is the way that, you know, you have to know certain things about Russia, economic power. That has been our aim throughout U.S. history, was to make China a rising power. Be careful of what you wish for. You may get it. And there was this belief that, you know, if we help China, quote unquote, and it rose up, they would adopt our political system as well as our economic system. We've seen they adopted the portions of our economic system that they saw working, and they didn't change their political system at all. And what you have is a situation. I go back to Paul Kennedy's best-selling, the greatest, great rarity, a serious work of history that became a bestseller in the 1980s, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. Unfortunately, all of his predictions were off. That's the problem with predictions. But he posited an interpretation of how and why great powers rise and fall. What he posited was that great powers rise when they have very limited number of things they have to defend, so they are underspending militarily while their economy is growing. That fit the United States perfectly throughout the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. A declining power, usually an empire, has a declining economic base, but tries to defend everything that it had at the height of its imperial power. And all that does is speed the decline of that power. A wise declining power understands the relationship between ends and means. And the United States is not a declining power. It's a declining power relative to other powers. Its absolute economic power is not declining. But there are other powers that are rising now faster, and their economies are growing faster than the U.S. economy is. And that economic power gives you military and diplomatic power. The Chinese are making clear that they're going to use it. The ironic result is that the United States and Vietnam are very close to becoming allies.
Who would have thought?
Because the Vietnamese are scared to death of Chinese power. They've had some pretty bitter experiences over thousands of years with Chinese power.
That's quite, clearly, it seems to me anyway, that the whole Chinese situation is going to be a very difficult problem, conundrum, whatever, for the U.S. Going forward to try and, you know, kind of manage
Except
things.
The one, thing is that economically, it is in both China's interest and America's interest to collaborate.
Do you think the tariffs that the Trump administration imposed continued? Or would that make sense to continue that? Or is that sort of bargaining chip?
No, and I don't think you'd find many economists who would favor tariffs. The United States has had a very strange relationship with tariffs over the years. Too complex for me to get into here. But the United States gave up on tariffs, or largely gave up on tariffs, when it became the greatest industrial power in the world. Rising powers use tariffs to protect themselves from cheaper goods coming in from more powerful countries, which is what we did vis-a-vis Britain during the early 19th century. There was for many years, the D.C. Watt pointed out, the great British historian, a favorite question on doctoral comprehensive exams. Doctoral comprehensive exam is an exam you must pass to be allowed to write your doctoral dissertation. You have finished your coursework. The question: free trade is the imperialism of the strong. Discuss. Bingo. Do you believe? And then there are arguments on both sides of that historical question. But historically, look at Great Britain. Great Britain favored tariffs, control trade, mercantilism when it was rising. Once it reached the top, it went for free trade, as did the United States. Right. I grossly simplified. I can just hear my colleagues who listen to this going, oh, come on.
It's way more complicated than that. Well, anyway, just in the time we have left, there were just two other areas I just wanted to touch upon briefly. One is Iran and the fate of the nuclear deal that we struck with them back in, 2015?
I'm just trying to cut this down background. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think it would be a wise idea for the U.S. to try and re-enter that nuclear deal with the Iranians, or is that ship has sailed and it's, you know, we've all moved on from there and it's sort of back to square one?
I don't know if that ship has sailed or not. My reading on the Iran nuclear deal when it was signed was that it was not a great deal, but it was the best deal we could get. I don't see our position having improved in terms of bargaining power. I think it's gotten worse in terms of bargaining power. What is the most likely scenario, and we're seeing it happen, is that Iran and the others who signed the deal will reach a new agreement, whether the United States joins or not, which will be in their interests. I think clearly Biden would like to go back to that, but it was so controversial here, I don't think, even if he had a Democratic Senate, I don't know if he could get the support that he needed for that. For those who oppose it, though, my comment always is, what do you suggest that would be better in the situation that we have?
Because it did seem to at least put a lid on the Iranians' ability to manufacture, you know, plutonium or, you know, the...
For a period of time. Right. I just don't, again, I am not privy to up-to-date intelligence. But when the deal was signed, I said, ugh. But what, you know, I can't think of anything better to do. Iran, basically what we see here is a recreation, attempted recreation of the Persian Empire. Iran has controlled the Middle East in the past, not always, far, far from it, but on occasion. And it has the resources and the population to do so. And as I said, we, by our stupidity, remove the greatest check on Iranian power. Henry Kissinger, again, this could be apocryphal, though it sounds just like Kissinger, during the Iran-Iraq war, which was a bloodbath, of course, I asked him, who do you favor? And he supposedly said it's one of those situations where it's a shame there has to be a winner. Let them kill each other, basically, was what he was saying.
Before we have to run, I just wanted to get your thoughts on the Paris Climate Accords. I mean, President-elect Biden has said that's going to be one of his first priorities, I think, on day one, going to sign
it. On day one, and he will.
Would that help sort of sort of ease some of the trust issues you were talking about at the beginning?
Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. I think it will ease them. But again, the thought how trustworthy is the United States? I'm sorry. I always have tried in my classes to give both sides of an issue, make up your own mind. This is what this side is thinking. This is what that side is thinking. In this one, I cannot, for the first time. I cannot. I think Trump belongs in an institution for the criminally insane. His weird conspiracy theories, his inability to tell truth from fiction, the fabric of a democratic society is very fragile. This country's democratic fabric has some give to it because of our history and our respect for law. But I see it fraying. Now, I will point out, Andy, that the pessimism that you hear from me also is a function of my age. I'm 75, and older people always think the world is coming to an end. In talking with people my age, I constantly have said, and many of my friends have said, yes, we know that that's the case, but this time it's real. And I said, how do you know that that's the case? We don't know objectively what's going on there. How much are we just behaving like cranky old men looking at this? But I joined the group that says we've got some very, very, very serious problems. And I think we have to figure out a way to heal our own divisions internally before we go taking on the world again.
And certainly a lot to do on that front, for sure. One last quick question before I let you go here. Who's your number one pick for Secretary of State?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that one. I would normally turn to the Senate, senators who had experience on the Foreign Relations Committee, for example. But with the balance in the Senate being so delicate, I wouldn't want to take any of those people out. I really don't have a pick for that position. It is the premier position within the cabinet. It's the first amongst equals, so to speak. I can think of many qualified people, but they all are in the Senate. If Biden is really interested in recreating trying to recreate a bipartisan foreign policy, then he might look to an internationalist, the old internationalist wing of the Republican Party. If not as Secretary of State, very high ranking. This is what Truman did. Marshall was not, when he appointed Marshall as Secretary of State, Marshall was not a Republican, but he wasn't a Democrat either. He was above politics, which is exactly what Truman needed in that situation. When he was asked what his political faith was, he would answer, my father was a Democrat, my mother was a Republican, and I am an Episcopalian. He refused ever to vote, so he was perfect for that position. But the position does politicize you. There is no way around it in the long run. Eventually, he came under partisan attack over the Korean War, the relief of General Douglas MacArthur, and the Europe first versus the Asia first strategy. I would look for somebody like that who could be seen as bridging the gap between the two parties. Mm-hmm. And I think the Republican Party has to decide, does it want to be unilateralist, a la Trump, or it's always been internationalist. In modern history, it's always been internationalist. It was part of that great bipartisan foreign policy that controlled U.S. policy in the world from 1941 up until very recently. But I can't think of anyone off the top of my head. Who would you like to see? I'll throw it right back at you.
I was afraid you were going to ask me that.
I was afraid you were going to ask me.
Well, I don't know. I'm just scanning through, okay, who Republican senators. I was thinking, gee, it would be interesting if you appointed Mitch McConnell.
No, I don't think that's a good idea.
I don't think so either. But that, that might solve one problem. I don't know. I mean, yeah. What's her name?
Susan Rice?
Susan Rice seems to be mentioned occasionally as an interesting, highly qualified sort of person.
The very reason that she was not, one of the reasons she was not chosen as the vice presidential nominee is a reason she would be good as Secretary of State, is that she doesn't have a strong political, I mean, she's a political appointee and has been in the past, but she has no history of being in the Democratic Party leadership. Let's put it that way.
Well, Professor Stoller, I think we're just about out of time here, but I have a feeling we could talk for another half an hour easily on all this. There's so many interesting things in play here on so many different fronts, and it certainly will be fascinating to see once the new administration does take office, how they approach some of these issues. Once, obviously, job one being managing the pandemic, which, of course, as you said earlier, is also a foreign policy question as well. But
most definitely.
Anyway, well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Stoller.
My pleasure.
Really great seeing you again, and
you too.
We'll be in touch.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.